again to The End of Religion, a podcast exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus. We're hoping that you are joining us and joining other listeners who come from a wide variety of spiritual backgrounds. People who are committed Christians, people who belong to different religions, or people who have long since opted out of religion and are at least willing to glance back over their shoulder as they kick the dust off their feet and walk away and say, well, is there anything there worth retrieving or considering? Maybe there are some atheists listening in or people who have just said, I want to chuck the whole thing, and they have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. But primarily, we're probably talking to people, or at least intend to be talking to people, who are on the one hand frustrated with Jesus, but still have, in fact, they hate Jesus, and why are we doing this whole podcast? On the one hand, they're frustrated with religion, but still have a soft spot for Jesus. And that's at least who the book is written to, The End of Religion, so we're walking through that. And by the way, my name is Bruxy Cavey, and I'm not alone here.
And I'm Tim Day, and I'm definitely not frustrated with Jesus, so I'm glad.
That's good. So we are exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus, thinking that there is something that needs to be mined out of the teaching of the historical, biblical Jesus. And in this episode, we're talking about who this Jesus is from a biblical perspective. I sometimes use the phrase historical, biblical, because both, to me, link together. It's not a binary choice for me between one or the other. And so we'll be talking a bit about that. Why in this book, The End of Religion, do we use the Bible as our primary source document for understanding his life? And what are the implications of that for us and how we use the Bible? We're working through what is the introduction in the book, The End of Religion. And as we've said before, maybe you have the book, maybe you've read it, and this will be kind of supplementary notes to you, and if you haven't read the book, feel free to get it, but hopefully there'll also be something of value to you even if you haven't. So is that enough?
Sounds great.
Introduction, Tim?
Let's dive in.
All right. Holy Hand Grenade is what the introduction is called. It seems as though, let me just try to explain what I'm getting at using that, first of all, besides pulling Monty Python into every opportunity for communication that I can. It seems as though there is a wonderful irony in the fact that it is the accepted holy text of the Christian religion that itself carries the ability to destroy the Christian religion from the inside out, that it is within the biblical narrative itself that the message of this subversive Jesus is most potent. There are other Gnostic texts and other mysterious texts that have arisen over time, but it's actually within the texts that have been received by the church, kind of welcomed in to the hierarchy and the institutional church. The one that's been welcomed in and received is the one that's ready to explode, you know? And it seems to me that, as we say in the introduction, that there's good reason, even just based on that, to not be looking at a variety of other texts to try and make some point based on often unsubstantiated theories, but to say, what does the Bible itself say, just for that reason? Now, I happen to also believe that the Bible is historically accurate in what it has to say about Jesus, but even for those people who can't go there or can't go there yet, there's still good reason to use the Bible and to study it thoroughly and see what kind of Jesus it really teaches us. What do you think about that, Tim? You just have to nod your head.
I'm just nodding at this point, making great points. I think in terms of the texts themselves, you know, talk about the Gnostic texts, it might be worthwhile for us just to unpack that a little bit. The four biographies of Jesus that were embraced early on, sometimes people point to the formation of the canon and sort of look at it with suspect eyes. But in reality, the early lists within the first Jesus movement, very quickly, these Gospels were the only things that were accepted as well representing his life and his teaching. And even for those maybe who've had a chance to look at them, the other sort of later writings, if you can say sort of the, I want to use the word fanciful. They're sort of expanded, elaborate, verbose at times, sort of carrying their own message. When you compare the later writings where they sort of launched off on Jesus' life and sort of created their own stories and attached it to him because he'd become a popular figure, you come back to the originals, you compare the two, you can see the obvious divide. The early ones really do read, as C.S. Lewis put it, and was a big part of his own conversion. It just read like first first century narrative.
Right.
It didn't read like myth.
Right. Richard Burridge, who is a scholar who's done an awful lot of work at this, written multiple books on the nature of the canonical Gospels, sees the evidence as rather conclusive that they fit the genre of Greco-Roman biographies.
Yes.
That most Greco-Roman biographies would follow up, would be about the length of the Gospels.
Yes.
Because they maximize the length to be able to fit on one scroll, so they don't have to become a two-part series. And that most Greco-Roman biographies might highlight some aspect of the birth of the person being described, but for the most part would highlight the later years, the adult years, the key events in the person's life.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the space, the time, the paper, the ability, the finances to create what we would call a biography today.
Yes.
That walks through every stage of the person's life. And so people often talk about the Gospels as though they're trying to hide something. Why does it tell more about his childhood and what happened there?
Yes.
Why do they just focus on his adult years and even the last few years of his life leading towards his death? But that is very typical for ancient Greco-Roman biographies. And so they fit well within their genre. In ancient biographies, we find when comparing different biographies for different leaders that the general significant events of that person's life are included, but they may be artistically rearranged,
mm-hmm,
in order, in aspect, in depth of discussion from one author to another. And so we see that also in the Gospels, that there is some reordering of things for flow, for narrative. But that was not considered deceptive. It was not considered somehow non-historical.
Right.
That the author was including the main events and arranging them in a way that allowed the flow, from the author's point of view, to work in the best way possible.
To tell the story.
Yeah, so I'm frustrated with people who kind of latch onto these people, and they, from a very chronocentric point of view, and
yes,
chronocentrism being the time or the historical version of egocentrism, saying that our time, from our point of view, from our chronocentric point of view, we will judge the four biblical Gospels based on what a biography would look like today.
Right.
And if they
right.
don't measure up to how we write biographies today, then we will consider them non-historical and mythological, and we'll poke fun of them. And there's no end of authors who tend to do that. And it's disappointing to me. It seems disingenuous and not particularly scholarly to do
mm-hmm.
that. So I do think that the Gospels provide us good history. But even if nobody believes that, they are still worth reading in order to see what the Christian church itself has embraced as its own and taught that people should follow. It's fascinating.
It is. And I think in that way, again, going back to the Gnostic Gospels just for a moment,
mm-hmm.
because they get a fair amount of popular attention.
Yes.
In Time magazine, McLean's magazine.
Yeah.
That the historical Gospels, actually, as you said before, are not only accurate, have all the signs, the sort of the fingerprints, the stamps
mm-hmm.
of solid historical writing of its period. I think of Luke as well.
Yes.
Called a physician.
Yeah.
And the evidence of his sort of scientific, or not scientific, but medical training, his elements that fit again within the genre of his day and
mm-hmm.
reflecting his point
mm-hmm.
of view.
Mm-hmm.
All of these good evidences. When you compare that to the Gnostic Gospels, again, it doesn't take long just in reading the two to realize the ones that we have in hand were not only accepted because of their early dating,
yeah.
wide usage, but just in comparison, the content is obviously rooted much more closely, as they indicate, in eyewitness accounts.
Mm.
The later ones having stories like Jesus as a little boy, you know, reaching out, grabbing a beam of sunlight and sliding down to see his friends.
It's very sweet.
You know, it's sweet, but it's just, you know, you can see it's sort of fanciful writing.
Yeah. And it's also, just to settle the whole thing, and some people still might want to push back and say, well, you know, the four biblical Gospels have some pretty fanciful stuff in there. Who
yes.
are you to judge? You only think they sound more historical because you're used to them. But let's put all that aside, all of the subjective judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the objective truths we can all agree on is the four Gospels that were chosen to be in the Bible are all first century documents.
That's right.
Bottom line is, they are written within decades of the actual events.
That's right.
The Gnostic Gospels are all second, third and sometimes fourth century documents that are written much later. Now, that everyone can agree on. Mm-hmm. Even people who late date the biblical gospels, who say they happened much later than conservative scholars, late dating them means that they believe they happened toward the end of the first century, but they're all still first century documents. Right. And that is different to Gnostic texts. So just on the basis of decent fair-minded history, we would choose first century texts over mm-hmm. second and third century texts in order to get as close as possible to the historical Jesus. And that settles it for me.
Yeah.
So we look at the biblical gospels, and we are making those the foundation as we walk through this book, The End of Religion, and talk about the historical biblical Jesus. And one of the things that we find is that the gospels are embedded within a larger collection of texts that have been written over a large time span, some coming out of the Hebrew religion of Judaism, the story of Israel, and some being Christian texts reflecting back on the mm-hmm. life of Jesus and helping the early church grow. And the Gospels are kind of embedded within the middle of that. And as we see their role and where they fit in the larger picture, it helps us understand... Well, it helps us understand the entire Bible better. And as we understand the entire Bible better, it helps us understand the Gospels better. Tim, give us a picture of where the Gospels, those Greco-Roman biographies of the life of Jesus, where they fit in the bigger picture of the Bible from start to finish. Because if people just open up their Bible and start reading from the beginning, it's going to be a while till they get to the Jesus bit.
A long time, actually.
So what's the deal with the whole, with the big picture?
I think that's an important point. And context is everything.
Yeah.
And so the story of Jesus, really, even as you read his the biographies, the people who are writing them mm-hmm. understood the larger context, mm-hmm. understood the larger story.
Yeah.
And so I think it's good for us to pause and just do a quick walkthrough. Here's my best attempt.
Okay.
The beginning of the story of Israel, or the story of humanity, according to the Bible, it opens with the creation of all things and God being the main character creating life as we know it today. Mm. And so if you want to think of this story, the unfolding story of God, as a drama, you could frame it as a drama that has six acts. It's like a play that has six acts. Mm-hmm. The first story is the story of creation. Mm-hmm. The first act is the story of creation. The second is the fall of humanity, what went wrong. Mm-hmm. The third act is the story of Israel, mm-hmm. a small people group that God begins to work with. Yeah. The fourth act is the story of Jesus. And then the fifth act is the story of those that would follow Jesus, the church, mm-hmm. This new community that was born out. And then the sixth act, the final act, is the story of when God sets everything right again, mm. where we sort of start with perfection and end with perfection. This is sort of the six-act drama that we see played out and revealed to us, captured in this library of books that we call the Bible.
So it's played out in the Bible. It's also, if you believe it, it's the story we find ourselves in, that we are, it plays out in our own lives too. We're kind of in Act 5.
Yes.
Right? We're still the ongoing story of the Jesus movement, of the people following Jesus. If he's Act 4 and Act
That's
5
right.
is the church. Yeah.
Yeah, we find ourselves, if you believe the story or as you engage the story,
yeah.
You're meant to find yourself within the story.
Hmm.
So as we walk through it, the beginning of the first act, what we find actually right off the bat in Act 1 is that In the perfect order of things, everything that used to be worshipped in the ancient realm, the sun, the moon, the stars, mm. as divine elements in yeah. creation, yeah. the very first thing that they declare right off the bat is, none of these things are deities. Mm. None of these things are to be worshipped. There's one God that is other.
Mm.
And so right off the bat, what's interesting about Scripture, we talk about it, you know, as an overarching narrative to wipe out religion.
Yeah.
When you read the very first verses, this first poem would have, in the ancient realm, leveled the known religions of their day.
Mm.
It would have said, everything that you've been worshiping, for all their beauty, for all their wonder, are simply creative expressions of the one true God.
The one true God is far more magnificent than anything you've yet conceived.
Yet conceived. And everything that is encased in your religion
yeah.
is pointing you in the wrong direction.
Mm.
And so as we get into the early creation, it's a beautiful narrative account of what the human heart is longing for. It is humanity living in naked vulnerability before each other in intimacy with their Creator, being able to live in harmony with their created order, partnering with God to make a perfect world better,
mm-hmm.
Living in a garden context is the picture. Mm-hmm. No rules, no regulations, no temple, no priest, no government, no prisons.
Mm-hmm.
It is a world that is governed by love. Mm-hmm. It is a world where your vulnerability, your that sort of naked and unashamed,
yeah.
is a basis for intimacy.
So one could say that this world that God created in the first place is a world that is, and it's the world that He originally intends and originally designs before anything goes wrong, is a world that is characterized by the conspicuous absence of religion.
That's right.
Right? It's you don't have to go to a certain temple or certain building. You don't have to go through certain rituals in order to make God appear or in order to petition Him or to somehow get His forgiveness. It
yes.
is just God and people hanging out together.
That's right. And the only thing you can imagine or project out of this garden, this perfect created world, is a loving family.
Mm, mm.
There is no religion. The yeah. only institution, if you want to think of an institution, yeah. is just relationship.
Mm, mm.
What else is interesting is that there is only one boundary. We talk about no rules. There was one boundary.
Okay, good. I was going to bring that up.
Okay.
All right, good.
There are two trees pictured in this story. The tree of life that if they would eat at it would provide eternal ongoing existence for them.
Right.
But there's one tree they weren't supposed to eat. The only boundary in the whole sort of created order.
Yeah.
And that was a tree that's translated the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I'd like to suggest just from the scholarly research I've done that sort of an on-the-street simple translation is maybe better to call it the tree of I'll decide for myself what is right and wrong.
Okay. So it's in the text it's translated the tree of the knowledge
of good and evil.
The tree, or a paraphrase could be the tree of
I'll decide for myself what is right and wrong.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is because that word knowing in the text is not a knowing like, oh, I found out some new information about what's right and wrong.
Right, right.
It's a knowing in the Hebrew sense, if you want to say, let me use another example of using the word know this way. That guy really knows his trade. What that means is he has mastery over his trade.
Mm.
He has a knowledge that has a command of it.
Mm.
And so
it's experiential knowing.
It's experiential knowing, but it's more than just even it's knowing fully. Some commentators will talk about this word maybe being closer to the word judging.
Mm.
It is a knowing that leads to judgment, to decision, to having a mastery. I know for myself what is good and evil. And that's where I think it tips more towards a better translation is not just I know for myself what is good and evil, but I'll decide for myself what is right and wrong. I think that's more what's coming out of it. And that makes sense in the context when the follow-up to that is I'll decide for myself what is right and wrong. I'll be like God. Right? That was what the end point was. I'm going to be like God. I'm going to be my own God. Tim will be God for myself. And I'm going to decide what's right and wrong. You can see in that context of loving relationship, of mutual submission, living in harmony with God and with each other, how destructive that would be for the individuals within. Say, I'm going to just decide for myself what I want to do. I don't care about what you think.
Yeah, yeah. So now you've got a world without religion with one boundary that's given, and it's really a boundary that calls people away from self-reliance, from disconnect of relationship.
That's right.
To continue to feed on God's life, on His grace, on His presence. And so one choice, though, is left for us. So in some sense, I've often thought that the need for one choice is necessary if you want to create a being that has full potential to love.
Yeah, I think you need a door out or else it's a trap.
Or the fact that you stay is not necessarily an act of love.
Or a relationship.
Right. If I often say, you know, if Nina told me, Bruxy, Nina's my wife, if she said, Bruxy, you're the man for me, but she said that, and if I was the only man on the planet, that wouldn't necessarily, you know, bless my heart that she said that. There has to be other men as an option for her statement that I'm the man for her to actually be an act of love and a grace towards me.
That's right. Love would demand, true relationship would demand a freedom to walk away from that relationship. Mm. If not, you're a puppet.
Mm.
You're a toy. You're a pet. You don't have a choice.
So the necessary ingredients for a loving, intimate relationship are all there. They're all there from the beginning. No religion.
Incredibly simple. Incredibly beautiful.
Naked and unashamed.
Act 2, the fall, is really Adam and Eve being deceived by a mysterious serpent that we really know nothing about at this point. What's a talking snake doing in the garden.
Right.
But anyways, a mysterious serpent, he represents an agent of evil. Mm. There's obviously a bigger story to this story.
Right.
Right.
And maybe we'll find out what that is later.
Later.
Yeah, but right now there's something nefarious that's coming about.
That's coming about. Tempts Adam and Eve. They go into their own rationalization. They decide, I want to decide for myself what is right and wrong. They eat the fruit. All of a sudden, their nakedness is transformed by their disconnection from God.
Hmm.
They immediately become conscious of their nakedness. It's a powerful symbol of how being rightly connected to God makes us secure, so that even when we're weak and vulnerable, we still feel safe. Hmm. Once we're disconnected, our vulnerability becomes a source of being threatened. And so now they're naked and feel ashamed. They want to hide. They want to cover themselves up. They're broken in relationship from each other. They're broken in relationship from God. And in this section of Scripture, there's a wonderful statement where Adam and Eve are confronted by God. And God challenges them, basically, what are you doing? And Adam says, I was afraid because I was naked and so I hid.
Hmm.
In their decision to break relationship with God, become independent, now their own vulnerability becomes a basis for fear.
Hmm.
The core of the human heart has now been transformed into one that is inherently afraid of its environment, afraid of other people, and takes the posture then of, I was afraid because I was naked, because I was vulnerable, and so I hid. That hiding is hiding your true self. It's saving yourself. It's doing whatever you need to do to put yourself in a place of your own self-created safety.
Hmm.
And so these bushes then that they're hiding and trembling in become wonderful pictures to us of asking how, in our separation from God and our broken relationship from each other, how are we hiding our true selves? How are we trying to save ourselves? And I come back to that, I think in a lot of ways religion, what we create are our own bushes. There are ways in which we create systems, rules, regulations, the magical approach to religion or intellectual approach to religion, whatever your version is, where you hide in to make yourself feel better, to feel like you have got something figured out.
Yeah.
We talked in the previous podcast about the older brother out in the field, his own self-righteousness. That was where he was, trying to do something to make something of himself. And I think at the core of the human heart, we see here in the fall that our broken relationship with God has made us fearful beings, and we become self-saving. We become self-rescuing.
Right.
And this second act then launches Adam and Eve out into a life now where they have to manage. And
they're chosen the back door. And so God grants them that freedom. Even as you're describing this, Tim, I think people have got to be listening and saying, I can relate to that sense. Whoops, that's my submarine sounding cell phone. Hold on a second. There we go. Okay. people who are listening, I know I certainly can, might think, now, I can relate to the sense of feeling vulnerable if I was to allow people around me to know too much of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
That if I was to say, here is everything about me, if I was to take that part of me that that I'm most ashamed of or afraid of and actually let other people know, I would feel like I would die. That I survive emotionally within the world today because I always keep at least a certain amount of myself hidden.
That's
even
right.
Sometimes from those who appear to know me
the
most
best.
Intimately. Yes. And so this is not just something that happened thousands of years ago in Genesis chapter 3, but this is the ongoing struggle now that we're living in the fruit of this today.
That's right. And so I think in this, the unfolding story then, as you get into Act 3, I think people who realize this part of Act 1 and 2, okay, what I really want is the reality of Act 1 in my life. I would love to live in that kind of freedom and intimacy, free of religion, self-saving, but I do live in Act 2 realities. I am hiding myself. I do have that fear. I am sort of not living in that same freedom with God and with other people. Act 3 then.
All right. So Act 1 is creation. Things the way God originally intended. Act 2 is the fall. Everything goes wrong. We take the back door.
Act 3 then is really begins to make sense of a lot of the human race. God begins to work with a family. To make it real simple, he picks a nobody out in the middle of nowhere to be his best friend. Starts to work with them, says, hey, you're going to have a big family. I want to start working with this family. This family becomes a case study for the rest of the human race. And what's interesting in this story, it's a story of Israel. It's basically one big family. one big extended family coming from a grandfather and some grandsons, and that's who Israel is. That's their story. What we discover is everything that doesn't work to change the human heart. If the human heart is afraid and naturally self-centered, what doesn't work? And actually, if you read this through the story, we could probably do a whole series of podcasts just on this.
Yeah, that's true.
But what you find out in the story of Israel is four things that don't work to change the human heart. Give me all the rules. Tell me, just tell me what to do.
Right.
Number two, give me my space. Keep all the bad people away who are going to tempt me or distract me. Mm. Give me strong leaders to help manage my life and keep me in order. Mm. And then hold me accountable when I screw up.
Yeah.
You take those four principles, that's played out 1,000 times in the story of Israel. Mm. They're given the Torah by Moses, a leader who leads them and gets them launched as a nation. The Torah is the law. We talk about this in the end of religion.
Yeah.
All the rules, all the regulations, everything's codified. Mm-hmm. What exactly are you supposed to do? In fact, that wasn't enough. They add their own traditions later.
Right.
That's explained in the book.
Yeah.
They are given the promised land, a wonderful little cocoon, a place to hide out.
Mm-hmm.
They're given kings, all different types of kings. Yeah. And then they are held accountable in a huge way by God. And do you know what you find out at the end of that whole story is none of it works.
None of it works.
God tells them all the way through, none of this is going to work.
Right.
And it just doesn't work.
And now some of it, you've labeled them, give me all the rules I need, give me the space I want, et cetera. Now, it's fair to say some of them are initiated by God, some by people. Like the kings, kings, for instance, are initiated by the people saying, we want to have kings like other nations. And God says, well, it's not really going to
work.
That's right. We want a temple like the pagan religions.
That's right.
And God says, I just need a tent, the tabernacle. No, we want a temple. And so some things are initiated by people, and God acquiesces. Other things are initiated by God, which raises the question, why would God initiate something that he already knows is not going to work? That's the big question that then the New Testament does answer. And we do get to that later in the end of religion, but the book of Galatians, for instance, is one of those New Testament books that answers that question. Why would God say, here, rules will be good for you for a time, but ultimately they're not going to serve the final purpose, and we'll have to move on for those.
That's right. And in fact, as you read through the story, even in Israel, in their original documents, all the clues are there because, let's say, when Moses gives the Torah, he actually tells them in the prologue and in the conclusion, none of this is going to work. Right?
Yes, yeah.
And as you go through it, there's actually striking examples in the story of Israel where this, give me the rules, give me my space, give me strong leadership, hold me accountable. The striking examples of the key leaders who live in complete contradiction to this, who live just simply as friends of God, who transcend all the rules, and they're just living as friends of God, Moses being one of them.
Yes.
Right? Or King David.
King David breaks the rules.
There's all different times where he's breaking the law.
Yeah.
And even in one of his most famous writings, Psalm 51, he says, do you know God? You don't care about all the religious sacrifices, all the religious ritual. All you care about is the human heart, and whether you have a humble heart. And so here within the story of Israel, then, they come to a dramatic conclusion as a nation that has not achieved the life that everybody's looking for. They're in slavery. They're in bondage. Their religious system is pathetic. The prophets are declaring, you need God to change you from the inside out, and you need a rescuer to come save you. Back in the story of the Garden of Eden, when they are kicked out of the garden and said, look, it's over. We're going to have to do this. God's going to have to rescue us out of this mess.
Yes.
The promise that he gave to them is there would be a descendant of Eve who through his suffering would put an end to evil. And so at the end of the story of Israel, they're longing for this descendant to come.
Now, some people might say, wow, man, that sounds like a harsh criticism of harsh critique of Judaism as a religion. But actually, it's an in-house Jewish revelation of itself. In other words, the Jewish scriptures are a vulnerable scripture. There's a beautiful thing about the Hebrew Bible. It's fascinating because here is a people group who their own scriptures are not the scriptures of how wonderful we are and how successful we are because we've got God on our side. It's actually the story of repeated failure and the lessons that are drawn out of that. And for that, we've got to, I think, hold our Jewish friends up in high esteem to say your scriptures are vulnerable, and we dare not use that as an excuse to somehow downgrade or be insulting towards the Jewish people, but to say, no, the Jewish story becomes the story of every person.
And that would be my feeling, too. I'd want to communicate that strongly. And this is a story we should find ourselves in.
Right.
That this is my story.
Right, yes.
Right? In terms of saying, my attempt to organize my life with all the right rules. Mm. I've keep all the bad people out of my life, trying to find the perfect leader to follow, getting people to kick me in the butt.
Yeah.
At some point in time, I have to, along with what the prophets of Israel said, mm. I have to come to terms, you know, Tim, this ain't working.
Yeah.
I need someone to get inside my heart and make a big difference there right. and give me a new heart. And that's mm. essentially what their own key prophetic leader said to them mm. as a nation.
Right.
So when Jesus steps on the stage, he's stepping right at this point in the story as a carrier of a radical message. Yeah. And that is this whole system. It's time to shut it down.
Mm.
All of what doesn't work, it's time to end it. Mm. And as God's unique messenger, it's called the Messiah, the Christ, the Anointed One, the coming King, the one they're yeah. anticipating.
Yes.
One of the phrases used out of Isaiah, Emmanuel, God with us.
Yeah.
This injection of God himself, apparently, into the story mm. to say it's time to shut this whole thing down. Mm. And his story then and his life and how he lived was revolutionary.
Yeah.
Again, many things we talked about in the last podcast, you can just, if you listen to it, just insert it right here.
Yeah.
A radically restored commitment to open friendship with God. God as a father, not as a distant, angry judge. Mm. Living an intimate relationship within a family-style setting where everybody's welcome just for who they are. No need for religion. You can step free from that. Mm. Doesn't matter how messed up you are or how righteous you think you are. Step free from those two sort of dysfunctional ways of living and enter into a community where everybody's welcomed equally into, and this is a transnational, transracial yeah. Family that just welcomes everybody.
Yeah.
And so as Jesus then steps into the story here, we see Act 4, the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
We see the story of what does work. Right. And it's very counterintuitive.
You think people would be ready for that then and say, okay, this has not worked. Thank you, Jesus, for bringing a new way. But people by that point have emotionally bonded with the rules, with the land, with the accountability, with all of the things, with their kings, with the nationality. They've emotionally bonded with their religion, so that even though God would say that was for a season, and you see how frustrating it is, and I'm willing to alleviate the burden of this. I mean, Jesus talked about it as a burden. They say, no, we want this. You can't be of God if you're going to bring us that message.
Well, that's the thing. And I would say the reason they're bonded is because I'm bonded to it. And yes. I have to deal with it myself. Like
this is not a uniquely Jewish issue.
It's a human issue.
That's right.
We want to order our environment as yeah. a way to change our hearts. We want to change ourselves from the outside in.
Hmm.
And all those four things that we talked about from the yeah. story of Israel is what the human heart wants. I think if I can have the perfect environment.
Yeah.
Sometimes parents have this with their kids. If I just put my kids with a good, you know, good school, good group of peers,
yeah.
you know, good teachers, good leaders, then my kids will be all right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I say for myself. If I just had the right training coach, I'd want to actually exercise.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I could get the right regiment
yeah.
and have
I'm
all the
still
right...
looking for the right formula.
If I could have all the right props, yeah. I will do the right thing.
Yes.
And so Jesus, when he comes, it's very counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It's flipping on its head. And here's what he says. And you look at his teaching over and over again. Get rid of the rules.
Hmm.
Learn how to love case by case.
Hmm. Now, some people who haven't jumped ahead in the book are going to say, what, get rid of the rules? That's anarchy. How can you do that? And all we can say is...
Keep reading.
You'll keep reading. Yeah, we'll get there.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
And so he goes through each of those four and flips it on its head. Hmm. Says, you know, you want your little safe cocoon where you keep all the bad stuff out of your life?
Hmm.
No, actually, get close to enemies. Hmm. Stare them in the eyes.
Yeah.
Because, you know what, they're just like you. And God's at work in their life, too.
Wow.
And same with the leaders. He flattens the whole hierarchical approach to life
yeah.
and says, you know what, you're all brothers and sisters.
Mm.
If you want to be great, become like the least.
Yeah.
You want to lead, learn how to be a servant. And the same with harsh accountability. The story of the prodigal son is a good example.
Right.
Learn how to love with lavish grace.
Huh.
Train the human heart, not with harsh accountability, but with a lavish type of grace that almost seems stupid. That when the heart is loved that way, it wants to be loyal.
Hmm.
And so but when you always beat it down with harsh accountability, it actually increases the amount that it's afraid.
Hmm. And it becomes a competition. What can I get away with?
What can I get away with?
The loophole mentality.
Rather than that loyalty.
Yeah.
And so Jesus flips everything on its head. And as we come then through the final part of Act 4, he lays his life down sacrificially
hmm.
as a perfect one who didn't need to die,
mm-hmm.
but in that process of dying was able to do some sort of miraculous divine swap with everybody else who really deserves to die for just all the terrible stuff that we've done.
Right.
And then, again, it's a mystery. But the message is declared that somehow when he died and then was raised to life again, divinely by God, in a, attested by multiple witnesses, people who are willing to die for their witness, that something happened in history. It's like the hinge of history. A turning point happened in history where just as Adam and Eve back in the garden made a single decision that ultimately set a series of dominoes to fall in place where all of us were born into a screwed up planet.
Right.
Jesus in his death and resurrection opened up a way for that decision to be reversed. And a new doorway is opened up where we can step out of sort of a predetermined way of living that we're just all going to repeat the same human failure over and over again. A new life, a new way of being restored to God, a new type of right standing, totally apart from religion, totally apart from any sort of ritual or system, where we just simply, on a friend-to-friend, parent-to, or child-to-parent relationship, come to God freely and say, do you know what? Jesus has something I want. Will you give it to me?
Yeah.
And God just offers it to him.
I want your life. And then, and in some sense, it's coming back to feeding on the tree of life that was there in the first place, Garden of Eden, coming to God directly for his provision, not to a religious institution. So Jesus dies as, well, the imagery in the New Testament is the sacrificial lamb. You know, John the Baptist said, behold the lamb who takes away the sin of the world. We think, what a beautiful poetry. But again, it's subversive. It's irreligious. It is through literal lambs, sacrificial lambs, on a daily basis at the temple that priests made a living and people got supposedly forgiveness of their sins.
Yes.
So for Jesus to be that one lamb is to actually say within the language of the religion of his day, I'm here to be and do everything that you're turning to the religion to be and do. And in the end, that just makes religion redundant. It's all taken care of by God himself.
Exactly. And so is this.
And we're only at Act 4.
We're Act 4. Act 5 is pretty simple. It's them struggling to live this out now. It's people just like you and me. You read the early letters. You read the early history written by Luke. It's just average people struggling with this. Do they get it perfectly? No.
Again, it's vulnerable scriptures.
It's vulnerable.
The New Testament follows the Jewish precedent of saying, here are letters and stories of the church getting it wrong as well, and sometimes right.
The biggest plot twist in this is that for all the people who are following Jesus and responding, that in the story of the church, there's a guy who is virtually, you know, by his own testament, the most religious dude around. His name was Saul, and he was part of the Pharisees. He was called himself the Pharisee of the Pharisee. He was the most religious guy, and Jesus miraculously, post-death, appears to him, post-resurrection, I should say, appears to him. Revolutionizes his life and basically turns him into a one-man wrecking religion wrecking machine. And he, as a totally religious guy, has his internal polarity completely reversed, and he gets it.
Yeah, the fact that Jesus would choose, it's like the last final pope. Right? Jesus said, now for my last song, you know, before I come again, I am going to choose the uber leader of the early generation, and he will be a thoroughly religious, pharisaical leader. And he will have the ultimate conversion experience. But he then brings to the table the Apostle Paul, who Saul becomes. He brings to the table all of his religious knowledge, his knowledge of the scriptures, his knowledge of what doesn't work. So he comes with this passion to say, do you guys get what a radical, transforming, irreligious message this really is? And his, you can tell his passion, his joy, his mind-blowing trippiness with the whole message just pours out in all of his writings.
And so this, you know, as the New Testament ends, these letters end, and we begin. It really then becomes for us, as we continue to live out this story, is are we going to get it?
Right.
Are we going to get this message? The final act, which is just simply a promise. You know what? At some point in time, God's going to stop all of this. He's going to hit the stop button. And those that buy in and want to live in love, and some are going to be surprised and think, wow, I wasn't even totally tuned in. I was just living, you know, out of a heart position. are going to be welcomed in. There's going to be some who think, you know, I've done the religious thing. Mm-hmm. I've been doing Jesus over and over again, right. who don't get it. Yeah. So we can't judge where people stand exactly at the end of time. But somewhere God's going to stop it and say, we want to get back to just living as a family. Mm-hmm. And the final act is mm-hmm. that restoration of the perfect order.
Oh, that's beautiful. And that takes us to the end of the book of Revelation, where the last couple of chapters end up describing something that looks very similar to the original Garden of Eden.
That's right.
And now you have the tree of life all over the place, but you don't have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We've gone through that experience.
Yes.
We've learned what doesn't work. And so Revelation concludes by saying, here's the world that God is taking us toward. Genesis says, here's the world God originally yeah. intended. Revelation says, and now he's taking us onto that world, a world, again, without religion.
And what an incredible hope.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about the meta-narrative, where does Jesus land?
The meta-narrative.
The meta-narrative. Meta-narrative of Scripture. That's a word to describe the big story.
The big story.
The overarching story. I hope as we've just done a quick walkthrough in our own way, you're able to capture the focus that we have within the end of religion, Brooks, your book, zeroing in on Jesus, is not something that stands in contrast to the rest of Scripture, but actually is the focal point, is the bullseye of the entire message of Scripture.
Yeah.
That it's all leading up towards and pointing back to ultimately what God wanted to reveal to us in Jesus.
That's fantastic. I mean, that really... that recalibrates our thinking completely on what the Bible is all about. It is not just the boring holy book of the Jewish and the Christian religion. It's the amazing story of the history of the entire planet, continuing, stretching on into the future.
That's right.
How we started and how we will end with no religion, and how Jesus came in the middle of it all to say, why don't you start living that way now with no religion, but with that intimate relationship with God.
Exactly.
So now the Bible, what a cool book. I like it. Listen, we've probably said enough for this podcast. This gives people an introduction as to why we see the Bible as a holy hand grenade.
Yes.
And why we see that the Bible is the place to go to find the most subversive portrait of the historical Jesus. Mm-hmm. We don't need to turn elsewhere. And let me just close by saying something that is in the introduction. Jean Vanier's quote is in the introduction where he says, I have learned that the process of teaching and learning, of communication, goes in two directions at all times. I remember hearing him say that in the Massey lectures and thinking, that is so true. Mm. That he's a profound speaker and teacher, and he lives out what he teaches. And I've been really encouraged by his work. But the fact that he would see all teaching is really... dialogue and wanting to learn as well at the same time. And that reminds me that I would love to see this book and this podcast become as much as a book and a podcast can, which are by nature, they tend to be unidirectional forms of communication. But as much as possible, I would love to see this become a dialogue so that even as Tim and I are having dialogue at this end, why don't you make it relational at your end? Is there someone else who you could invite to begin to listen to the podcast with you as we go through chapter by chapter? Is there someone else who you can invite to read the book with you and turn that into an experience of friends talking about the different concepts in the book, or a bunch of people getting together for a book club, some kind of a group discussion, if it's a church group, a Bible study group, however you want to organize that, but make it relational in the process of discussing this. And also, why don't you make it relational with us by just giving us feedback on this podcast and on the book? You can write to feedback@theendofreligion.org. feedback@theendofreligion.org, and we would love to hear from you and respond to questions and just get feedback in general. That would be awesome. Hey, have we figured out a closing shtick? Yeah?
Tune in next time.
Well, months later, we're still trying to figure out how to close the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.